And it is indeed a great pleasure to welcome back to this program an old friend, Tom Wicker, who for so many years was the leading political writer at the New York Times, was their Washington bureau chief for many years, a regular feature, columnar feature on their editorial page. And you began for the Times as their man in the White House, didn't you?
Well, I didn't literally begin as the man in the White House, but I did do that. I covered the White House beginning in the Kennedy administration. But when I first went to Washington in early 1960, I covered Congress for a while. I even, believe it or not, covered the Department of Agriculture briefly.
Well, I can believe that. You're a good old North Carolina boy, aren't you, originally?
Yes, but my career as a covering the Agriculture Department ended very abruptly when I referred to bales of cotton.
Aren't they bales? What are they?
No, I'm sorry. They are bales.
Yeah.
I referred to bushels of cotton.
Oh,
that was the end of my career.
That was a mistake.
It was indeed.
But your first president, that is the first president who was in action when you were a young reporter in Washington, was Dwight Eisenhower.
I went to Washington as a correspondent for the Winston-Salem, North Carolina Journal in early 1957, just in time to hear President Eisenhower's second inaugural address. And then I was in Washington for about a year and a half, went back to Winston-Salem, and came back in 1960. I did cover President Eisenhower briefly.
You covered Eisenhower. You covered everyone following him. Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush 1. By the time Clinton
you,
was...
You skipped Kennedy and Johnson, which were in there as well.
Kennedy and Johnson, of course. By the time Clinton was inaugurated, you were working for the Times, but you're up in New York.
No, I retired at the end of 1991.
Very close to the time when he was inaugurated.
That's right. Well, he was elected in 1992, and that was the first presidential campaign in, 30 years, I guess, that I had watched on TV rather than covering, in fact. I didn't cover the Clinton campaign other than watching it on TV and so on.
Did you ever meet him, though? I'm sure you did.
Oh, yes. I knew Clinton because...
as a governor, you probably knew.
As a governor, and he also had come to the New York Times while he was governor and before he was a candidate.
The obligatory routine for any aspiring American politician. Show up for a session with an editorial board of the New York Times and with the Chicago Tribune.
Well, certainly with
and the
Tribune.
And the Post.
They don't all come to the Times anymore, I don't think, but they did then. Yeah. They did for sure.
So I'm very interested in, and I know our listeners will be as well, in your impressions, your thoughts about all of these presidents. But before we turn to particular ones, overall, have we been well or poorly served by the roster of modern presidents?
Well, I think we've been reasonably well served, with some exceptions. One would think of the Watergate scandal and the Iran-Contra scandal. Mm-hmm. So I think we've been reasonably well served, but I think perhaps better than we deserve, considering the way we conduct our elections in this country. I think the American electorate is very vulnerable to negative and false campaigning and so forth, and we tend to fall for that. And I often think that the presidents we get perform better than we really deserve, because we elected them on a basis that had nothing to do with what they later did as presidents, or didn't do.
Let's begin to examine your impressions of some of them. Was Eisenhower really kind of kidding us all with his mangled syntax and his apparent public confusion at press conferences?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because I don't know exactly what he thought or whether he thought that out, although he did once say to Jim Hagerty, his press secretary, on some question, he said, "Don't worry, Jim, I'll just confuse him."
Yeah.
But whether that was a habitual matter or not, I don't know. But if you study Eisenhower's writings, I mean, those that you can trace to him directly rather than to speech writers and so forth, he doesn't show any example at all of confused syntax. I think he handled the language quite well. And indeed, you know, when he was a high assistant to General MacArthur before he became famous in World War II, he was MacArthur's speechwriter.
That was back in the Philippines, as
yes,
I remember.
Yes, that's right. And MacArthur certainly would not have had someone who couldn't handle English language as his speechwriter, because he himself could handle it pretty well.
And a famous quote from Eisenhower having to do somehow with... Somebody asked him, "What'd you learn from General MacArthur?" He said, "Well, I learned dramatic arts," or something like that.
He may have, and he also learned, I think, whether he ever said it or not, He learned to stay out of politics,
uh-huh.
except, of course, when he later was retired and ran for president. But as an Army officer for many years, he never dabbled in politics. And in fact, he never even voted.
The succeeding him is a brilliant young fellow that all the country, whether they voted for him or not, was sort of fascinated by, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Yes, indeed.
You did a book on JFK and LBJ. It's a single book.
I did that. I did that while Kennedy was still living in anticipation of having, it was going to be about JFK, and I was going to have it published in 1964, when, of course, he'd be reelected, and I'd mm-hmm. make a lot of money and get famous. In fact, of course, he was murdered, and so I quickly converted to a book about Kennedy and Johnson.
Weren't you on the scene in Dallas?
Yes, I was in Dallas when for the New York Times when President Kennedy was murdered.
Were you in the procession?
Yes. That procession went right through the heart of Dallas, and it was a long procession. There were enough of us in the press. There were two press buses in that procession. And so I can't say that I actually literally with my eyes saw President Kennedy shot, because I can't describe it now, but his car had gone around two corners before mm-hmm. we went around the first. Therefore, we only saw the scene after his car had sped away. In fact, we didn't even know that he'd been shot until we got out to Parkland Hospital and found that he not only shot, but was dead.
What? Of course, it would be vain to ask you, what are your memories of that day? You must still have rich and complex memories of it all. And in some ways, you may even have a touch of amnesia for it, because it was so horrible a scene.
Well, it was. It was terrible. And I've often said that, that story, I wrote a story that ran a full page inside the New York Times, plus the part on the cover. And I've often said that that story made my reputation as a reporter. It's a very hard way to have your reputation made. And I was extremely moved that day, not as someone might think, because I had all that great love for President Kennedy. I certainly admired him, but I wasn't any close friend or anything of that sort. But you will recall that was the first presidential assassination since McKinley. And I don't think anyone in our 20th century even remembered the death of McKinley, or if someone did, they were ancient.
Mm-hmm.
And so the assassination of President Kennedy was a highly emotional matter, I think not just for me, but for everyone in the press corps, and indeed all Americans that day. You will recall that for 3 days, or maybe even four, the television networks ran nothing else but visuals about the assassination and playing classical music. You can't imagine them doing that today.
I remember reading your story. I was a kid assistant professor at Yale University at that time.
Yes.
And, of course, I read your story and followed it all on television, and everything stopped in the country probably for a week or so. There was nothing to do but gather information about that, talk to your friends about it, and keep haunting the television set and the publications to try to get more detail. There was that weird, of course, it was how many days after the assassination was Lee Harvey Oswald killed by Jack Ruby?
Oh, it
only
was
about 3 days, isn't it?
No, President Kennedy was killed on a Friday. And,
the 22nd of November.
Yes, and Lee Oswald was shot and killed on the Sunday.
On the Sunday, two days later.
Yes, by Jack Ruby.
Were you still down there at that time?
Yes, I was. I stayed in Dallas through that, not for that event, because our correspondent from Los Angeles had flown in. We had correspondents coming in from everywhere. And I was in charge, briefly, at least as the man on the scene.
Sure.
And I sent him to the police station, and he actually saw the shooting of Jack Ruby. By that time, I was back in New York, back in Washington, I should say.
Overall, what would your assessment be about the presidency of John Fitzgerald Kennedy?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because he was, for two reasons. First place, clearly, his life and tenure was cut short. And secondly, he was such an engaging fella. I don't believe in all the presidents that I've known or had some remote relation to, going back to Eisenhower, I don't believe anyone has been as engaging, as charming, as witty as President Kennedy was.
And as popular with the press.
Well, it's popular with some of the press, not everyone, because the press tends to have its political attitudes as well. I mean, everyone likes to talk about the liberal press, but not everyone in the press is a liberal, believe me. Or certainly weren't during the Kennedy administration. But in any case, as to what I, with those qualifications, I thought President Kennedy was, in effect, a work in progress. I think Kennedy's second term would have been extremely productive. And I think some of the things that he did, like the beginnings of some kind of reconciliation with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, beginning with the American University speech in the summer of 1963. I think that's one of the great presidential documents of our time.
That was in June or July of 63. And of course,
it's a commencement address.
He was cut off in November of the same year.
Yes, just after he'd been visited his home city in Ireland.
Interesting historical question that still persists. Kenny O'Donnell, who was very close and was his adjutant for those years, starting way back in Boston when Kennedy first ran for the House.
Yes, indeed.
Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers did their book, Johnny, We Hardly Knew You.
Yes.
And O'Donnell, who appeared on this program a few times, always insisted, and he said so in that book, that it was the absolute intention of Kennedy to withdraw from Vietnam directly after the November election.
Yes, well,
others have contested that.
Yeah, I know that Kenny O'Donnell felt that way, and you can make an argument for that. And I've never quite accepted that argument. I think that it would be, I have always felt that had Kennedy lived and been reelected, as I'm sure he would have defeated Goldwater. I think the war would not have unfolded as it did. He wouldn't have pushed it to the extent that President Johnson did. He would have ameliorated it in some way from what, in fact, we knew at that time. The idea that somehow once reelected, he would say, well, that's that, and pull his troops out. So I've never believed that.
Of course, Kenny O'Donnell, peace be upon him, he went to his reward some years ago.
Oh, and much closer. He should know far more than I did about it.
But remember, he also told various people, he certainly told me and said it on the air, in fact, that there was no such person as Judith Campbell Exner, or if there was, she'd never been any place near the White House.
Well, that's Kenny was a very loyal soul.
He was indeed.
He was. I liked Kenny O'Donnell very much, but
I did too.
But I wouldn't want to say that he wasn't capable of building up President Kennedy in retrospect.
Another figure larger than life and in some ways stranger than life was the successor, the then vice president who became president on November 22nd, 1963, namely Lyndon Johnson. We've got some commercials coming. When we return, let us look at the presidency of Lyndon Johnson.
Fine.
Directly back to Tom Wicker after these words. Our guest tonight is a treasured old friend. I think I used that phrase once before, but it certainly applies. Tom Wicker, who had almost all of his career, his newspaper career, at the New York Times, though a few years first on a provincial paper down in North Carolina.
Well, of course, we didn't think of it as provincial.
You didn't. No. And I'm sure it was a fine paper. And as well as a vast amount of reportage, opinion columns regularly in the Times, you also did a number of books about public affairs and about American politics and American presidents and American presidential campaigns. We're going to come to some of that because you've covered that sort of territory once again with regard to George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush. But apart from all of that, you did some 7 or 8 novels.
Yes, I've forgotten the exact number, but I did do some novels, which my critics concede that all of them put together don't make one good one, and they may be right. But
well, I read the Civil War one. We did a program based upon it, and I thought it was a wonderful novel.
Well, the Civil War is one of those things that us Southerners dote on, you know.
Sure.
And I have been reading a lot, and I've done a lot of reading about the Civil War over the years, and I always wanted to write about it, and I did, finally. And I think I would put it this way, of the numerous novels that I wrote, that one is respectable.
You know that in real life I'm a social psychologist, and
yes.
this program is my moonlighting. Well, social psychologist, not a clinical psychologist. I don't deal with individual, never have dealt in a professional way with individual psychopathology. All the same, some of my best friends do. and you know perfectly well that there's been a speculation since he was in office and long beyond his run as President of the United States as to whether Lyndon Baines Johnson had all of his marbles.
Oh, there's certainly been a lot of speculation about that. I first heard that kind of thing when, it's forgotten now, but early in his tenure, after he succeeded Kennedy, he caused or ordered an invasion of the Dominican Republic. I've forgotten now what the cause was, but a number of people at that time felt that that wasn't really a balanced decision. I never felt in the years that I knew Johnson reasonably well, because you recall before he became vice president, he was Senate Majority Leader.
Sure.
And I had covered the Senate, and I had some knowledge of him. And I was a very close friend of his extremely able press secretary, George Reedy, who was a good friend of mine. And I never felt that Johnson really, in any sense that a psychologist would recognize, I never felt that he had a mental problem, and that he was mentally unstable. I think he had an overweening ego combined with a very distinct sense of inferiority. He didn't have a very good education. In fact, very little. And
he brooded about the people that he called the Harvards.
That's right. Jack Valenti was a Harvard.
Yeah.
Johnson felt, as a Texan, one thinks of Texans as being boastful, you know, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's a generality that probably isn't true. Johnson felt that somehow his background was inferior to that of an East Coast, a Harvard, as you put it, or an Ivy Leaguer or something of that sort. So he had this tremendous ego. At the same time, he had an inferiority complex, and the two produced very strange circumstances on occasion. And it's well known now that Johnson said in a number of occasions that he didn't intend to be the first American president who had lost a war. And that is one of the major reasons if not the major reason, that he maintained almost to the end the war in Vietnam. Towards the end, he seemed to have softened a little bit. He ordered the bombing halt, which he said he wouldn't do, had said previously that he wouldn't do. I think that's kind of unbalanced, in a sense, to feel that way about it. But at the same time, if I were president, I'm sure I wouldn't want to be a president who'd lost a war either. And so to attribute that kind of an attitude to, as you put it, he didn't have all his marbles, I don't think that's true. In fact, I thought that Lyndon Johnson was one of the most intelligent men that I had ever met. I also think he had a lot of, I think it'd be fair to say, psychological problems. And when I say that, I'm not talking about mental, that he was mentally unhealthy. I just think this huge ego and tremendous ambitions. We used to say when he was running for president, you know, in 64, we used to say he didn't want to just carry all 50 states. He wants to carry 50 states and the world. And that's true in many ways. He had this outsized ego and outsized ambition. Mm-hmm. And that distorted reality for him, I think, in probably in many ways.
You remember that story? I don't know where he's flying to, but he's about to get on. He's going on a visit. Maybe for that matter. Did he go during the war itself to Vietnam, I think?
Oh, yeah, I know the story you're talking about, where some fellow said,
exactly.
Mr. President said, your helicopter's over here. And he turned to the button, he said, son, he said, they're all my helicopters.
That's the story.
The story, I remember the joke that went around Washington. Well, you know, yeah. He used to drive a fast car in Texas. The joke that went around Washington was that this highway patrolman stopped him once. He was speeding.
Mm-hmm.
And then the patrolman came up to the car and got a look at who it was. So he was the president. He said, my God. And Johnson said, and don't you forget it either. That's just a joke. But it shows the way that many of us looked at him at the time.
Well, all presidents are ambitious, or they wouldn't get to be president, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
In your new book about the first President Bush, you certainly attribute a great deal to his ambition.
Oh, there's no question of it. No question of it. And it's bound to have been a burning ambition. Because I think it's fair to say, and I do say in my book, that he ran a very disreputable campaign against Dukakis in 1988, and I don't think you could have done that unless you felt that, you know, you could do anything to win. You'd do anything to win. And that same year in the New Hampshire primary, he'd run a very negative ad against Bob Dole. who was leading in the New Hampshire primary the last weekend. Bush ran this negative ad again, put together by Roger Ailes, in effect, wound up defeating Dole, and Dole never forgot that either.
We're going to come to all of that as we kind of work our way chronologically through the presidents. But following LBJ, well, of course, we have a very interesting and dramatic thing about LBJ, his decision not to run and his announcement quite early in the game that he would not run for a second full term. Of course, he had about a term and three quarters because he succeeded directly after Kennedy's assassination, and then he had his full term, but he could have run again.
He could run again because he only served a year of the Kennedy term.
Yeah.
And according to the constitutional amendment, therefore, he was eligible to run again in 68. And indeed, in 1968, it was one of the great guessing games in Washington. Would he run again? And I confess to my sorrow that I wrote a column in which I said, well, of course he'll run again. I mean, who can believe that Lyndon Johnson would not run, you know? That was one of the great clinkers of my career, I must say. But then, in fact, it was, I think, March of 1968, election scheduled in November, that he announced that he would not run again. And it had something, there were several causes. People who know Johnson well said that he really didn't want to run again.
Well, surely one cause was the New Hampshire primary, where he just eked out a victory over McCarthy by a few votes.
Well, it was better than that. But the thing was, I mean, I think McCarthy got 38% of the vote, as I recall. But McCarthy was on the ballot, and Johnson wasn't even on the ballot.
Yeah.
Some stand-in was running. So it was hailed as a great victory for McCarthy, Gene McCarthy, at that time. And it was, indeed. And I think that contributed considerably to Johnson's decision, but probably more was the fact that by the time he announced in March that he would not run again, it was clear, I think he was even an announced candidate, Robert Kennedy was running.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Johnson feared more than anything else that, as he looked at it, I'm not saying this, but I'm saying I think Johnson feared that the Kennedy family would come back and take it away from him, as he thought that they thought he'd taken it away from them.
There was supposed to have been a deep enmity.
The war had a lot to do with it as well. I mean, I don't mean to be trivial about it. There were a lot of reasons why Johnson didn't run. But
well, the country had kind of turned against the war by that.
It had not quite. It was turning.
It was turning, yes. I did a book, actually 4 years later, towards the end of the first Nixon term,
yes,
titled Vietnam and the Silent Majority. Remember, Nixon claimed that the silent majority of Americans still favored the war. We did an analysis of all the available public opinion polls demonstrating that that was not the case, that by 72, early 72, the country had really turned against the
absolutely,
Vietnam
no
war.
Question, by 72.
The measure of what we were writing in that book is that the preface was written by George McGovern, who was then about to run for the presidency.
Yes, George McGovern certainly felt that the country had turned against the war, and he did not a little to accomplish that as well. McGovern was a very bold candidate in the Democratic primaries and in the months leading up to that. And I think he had a lot to do with public opinion. But unfortunately, when he then ran against Nixon in 72, he lost a landslide. So the country had not, it might have turned against the war in Vietnam to a considerable extent, but not to the extent that it would support George McGovern.
In 68, after LBJ withdraws, we've got Nixon running against Hubert Humphrey.
Well, in the fall, yes.
For the presidency.
Yes, before that, of course, you had the very dramatic
the assassination
McCarthy
of Robert Kennedy,
contest, and then right here in Chicago, the Democratic Convention.
I was there.
Which nominated,
You were there too, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I was. The convention that nominated Humphrey.
Sure.
Or Humphrey, as Johnson used to call him. Southern pronunciation, you don't pronounce the H. Humphrey.
Let's come directly to Nixon. I guess we better come to him after some commercials. I'm late for those. I knew that you would throw me off my schedule because I'm too fascinated by talking with you. But we will return directly to Tom Wicker and on to other presidents who have known him. First, these words. And directly back to Tom Wicker. And we come to a man about whom you did another whole book, as I remember it, namely Richard Nixon.
Yes, I did. Richard Nixon and the American Dream was the title of that book. which I can say it's not a blurb because you can't find it anywhere if you go looking for it.
You did it after the end of his presidency.
I did, yes. He had been, after his resignation was, as I recall, in 74, and it was maybe 10 years later I did that book.
What a complicated man.
Extremely. I have said somewhere, I wrote, I guess, written so much I've forgotten where, but I think the two most interesting public men in my career were Johnson and Nixon, which doesn't mean the greatest or anything of that sort, but I mean the ones who were the most difficult to figure out and who were the most complicated and involved human beings. Nixon was a psychological swamp in many ways.
He was indeed. I've got a surprise for you and for our listeners. I've got a little clip I want to play.
Please.
Of an interview with Tom Wicker on the date of June 28th, 1973. We're still in the middle of the Watergate crisis, and on this very day, something interesting has happened concerning you and Richard Nixon. Here is the clip.
We have as our distinguished guest, and he'll be arriving a bit later on, he's on his way to the studio, Tom Wicker, the well-known columnist of the New York Times, formerly manager of the Washington Bureau of the Times. Tom Wicker, it turned out today, was one of the 20 people targeted by John Dean as he and other colleagues worked up that list of Nixon enemies, of administration enemies. Interestingly enough, Larry Roderick, and I'm now speaking to our second guest, Larry Roderick, our good friend from the WGN News staff, who's here with us tonight. Interestingly enough, Larry, a number of other people show up on that list. One of them is the vice president of the university at which I work, Don Bruckner, who used to be a newsman working as a syndicated columnist based with the Los Angeles Times. And Don seems also to be on the larger list of 300 or so. Another is Hans Morgenthau, a former colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, a very distinguished political scientist, who interestingly enough gets confused on that list with Robert Morgenthau, the former Democratic federal attorney in New York City. Have you looked at that list, Larry?
No, I've not looked at all the names. We've seen sketches and bits and pieces of it, enough to draw a fascinating conclusion, and that is that there was a real scattergun approach on the part of the Nixon administration, almost a sense of paranoia in some ranks. Anybody who wrote, did, thought, said, spoke a little bit against the Nixon administration would suddenly wind up in black and white as an enemy of the Nixon administration, to be watched out for, to be feared, to be dogged, to be bugged. And if John Dean is to be believed, to be burgled or anything else along that line.
Master list, and there's a special list of 20 men who are targeted for immediate action. And lo and behold, Tom Wicker's name doesn't lead all the rest because the list is in alphabetical order, but Tom Wicker's name is there as one of the 20. Well, Paul Newman and a number of other people have been asked how they feel about having been targeted. How do you feel about it?
Well, it's hard to say. I had mixed reaction to it. Of course, indignation in one sense, and then in another sense, considering the way that list is described by them as a list of people. I don't know. It's almost an honor to be on the list in a way. I don't feel that, but. It's quite true, you know. And the more I hear of the more I hear and see of these Watergate disclosures, the more it really is true. I am an enemy of people like this. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't be an enemy of people like this?
People like what? How do you exactly characterize them, Tom?
Well, people who construe political opposition as being the kind of enmity that justifies and even demands that they break the law in order to get them in some way, to destroy them, whatever it is that they want to do, that they'll use tax investigations, suggested that all kinds of possible scandals that might be evoked against some of the people on there. I think that's a pretty reprehensible thing. I must say, I had always assumed in this country, as long as I've been involved in reporting on politics and that sort of thing, I'd always assumed that political disagreement was, in effect, an agreement to disagree, that you could disagree bitterly, even violently almost, on a political question and yet maintain some kind of a civil relationship with the man, at least respect his rights and his integrity and so forth. Turns out that these people didn't feel that way at all. If you oppose them, somehow they construed you as having opposed the country or having opposed something else. Therefore, you had to be attacked and destroyed. And I think that's a reprehensible development in American life.
There you are, back to real time. You and I are 31 years older than we were
yes.
at that moment.
And feel every day of it, too.
Do you still hold the same judgment about Richard Nixon?
Well, I do, as far as President Nixon and all of the Watergate matters are concerned. I have since, as you pointed out, written a book about Nixon, and I think there are a lot of, I don't want to say exactly extenuating circumstances, but I know more now, and when I was writing that book, than I did in, when you were quoting me on, or you let me speak on TV then, on radio then, about the pressures that worked on Nixon, that work on all of us, and we all... We all, in many ways, are the product of what life has done to us, and I think Richard Nixon was, too. And that 30 years that you just mentioned is passing, I would like to think, it may not be true, but I'd like to think that I know a little bit more about life than I did 30 years ago.
I'm sure you do. I hope that I do as well. Even at the tragic end of it all, I felt terrible depression about and for Nixon. I was preoccupied in the months after that with this thought. Nixon is going to wake up this morning, and as he rubs the sleep out of his eyes, he's going to remember yet once again, I'm the first man who ever had to resign the American presidency.
That's right. Not only that, but as time goes along, he may be the only man. We don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to happen. We don't know. But and it's also forgotten because Watergate, the controversy that caused his resignation, it's like a big wall. Rising up, the American people look back at Dick Nixon, and all they see is Watergate, mm-hmm. Watergate, and the fact that he had to resign. And when, as a matter of fact, the first Nixon term, the first 4 years he served in office, was a pretty progressive term, a lot of good things.
I was about
happened.
To ask you, if we put Watergate aside, how then would we evaluate, or should we evaluate, the Nixon presidency?
Well, I think you can't put Watergate aside. That's the first thing to say. But if you go beyond Watergate and look back at the first term, Pat Moynihan, who served, of course, in that mm-hmm. administration, said it was the most progressive since Franklin Roosevelt. And I think in many ways it was. That was the term in which we got, for example, the environmental, whatever it's called, and Nixon instituted the voluntary army.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of things that in that first term that I think on the whole we would say, good. Well done.
The famous opening to China, would you count that?
Yes,
as well?
I certainly would. I certainly would. But the problem is, as I say, that people don't look back at that. That
yeah.
They stop when they get to Watergate and the fact he had to resign.
Of course, the man had guts of a strange kind. After all of that, you'd think he would want to go away and hide for the rest of his life. But he pops back in and wants once again to restore his reputation. He takes up residence in New York and then in a more... in a larger estate in New Jersey, near New York, and he writes books.
Yeah.
And he has conferences with your friends on the editorial board of the New York Times.
Yes, and became quite, I think, a learned figure on world affairs and so forth.
Did you deal with him at all in those days, the post-presidential years?
No. I tried to interview him when I was writing the book, and he wouldn't see me. So I went ahead anyway, and I yeah. interviewed a lot of people who knew him and had been in his administration. And then when the book came out, he wrote me a letter and kind of attacked me for not having interviewed him.
When
he would, I had tried many times.
Really?
But anyway, I think the Nixon administration and his later attempts to come back and win an honored place in American life, I don't know, you would know more psychologically than I, but it seems to me that if one is disgraced for whatever reason, you would, if you were a courageous man and an ambitious man, an intelligent man or woman, you would try to redeem yourself, to overcome that. And I think that's what he did.
Yeah.
And to a considerable extent, he did. He will never, in history or in memory, he will never escape the obloquy of having been the first president to be forced to resign.
Yeah.
He'll never escape that. But beyond that, he did reestablish himself in to a considerable extent.
It's interesting that John Dean, who put you on...
And who just has a new book out.
Just has a new book about the current administration, saying the title is It's Worse Than Watergate.
Yeah, well, I'm not, I think it's fair to say, even here on this regulated medium, I'm not an admirer of the current president, but I do not think you could say that anything this administration has done is worse in a legal sense or sense of illegality than Watergate was. Now, I think many of the policies that this president has followed, both policies in the larger sense, like the war in Iraq, or policies in a more specific sense, like secrecy and the Patriot Act and that sort of thing, I'm very much opposed to that. But I'm not aware that this administration has been crooked. And I think it's fair to say that the second Nixon administration, yeah, because of Watergate...
We find out the U.N. has possibly...
There was law-breaking involved.
We find out the U.N. has possibly been more crooked with the recent oil scandal, oil-for-food scandal.
That could be.
UN.
That's yeah, something I don't know anything about. I read a little bit about that, but personally I haven't done any work on it.
Of course, with... the end of that presidency, that is the forced resignation of Richard Nixon, comes this nice fellow from Michigan that we all sort of wanted to like, Gerry Ford, an utterly accidental president. He becomes president because he was vice president. He becomes vice president because Nixon had to get his vice president, Spiro Agnew, to resign.
That's true. And Gerald Ford was an appointed vice president, and then he succeeded the presidency when Nixon was forced to resign. Therefore, in a certain sense, he didn't have very much legitimacy. I mean,
he's
he had legal
president
legitimacy.
As well, yes.
And then when he finally ran for the office in 76, he lost to Jimmy Carter.
Sure.
But Gerald Ford was a very nice fellow. I remember, and he is. Of course, he's still very much alive, although he's not in the news nowadays at all that I know of.
He's into his mid-90s or thereabouts, isn't he?
He must be. He yeah, must be, one would think. I liked Gerald Ford. I had liked him when he was in the House. And as presidents go over the years, I think he was one of the more amiable and likable yeah, presidents that we've had.
And to evoke the Hippocratic Oath, he did no harm.
That's exactly true. Well, he probably did it that we don't know about. That's probably true of most presidents. But on the surface, yes. And the 3 years that he served were reasonably uneventful.
Let me present you now with the voice of the successor to Gerry Ford. On this radio program, he's been here three or four times, and here he is. One hopes.
What does lead experienced old hands at nuclear weapons and at strategic concepts, like your former boss, Admiral Rickover, what leads them sometimes to the dark vision that the game is almost up and we can't really escape the coming nuclear holocaust?
When I was president, I made frequent trips on some of our warships and airplanes just so I could understand what our defense capabilities were. One of the most interesting trips was to go out on the attack submarine to Los Angeles with Admiral Rickover. And we were cruising along several hundred feet under the surface in this beautiful warship designed by Rickover. And he told me that he wished that although he had devoted his life to the peaceful use of atomic power, that he wished that atomic power had never been discovered. Not just because he would be willing to give up all the advantages of ship propulsion and the generation of electricity in order to remove the threat of weaponry. History, I think, Rickover was a very fine historian. I think looking back, he is convinced that never in history have human beings developed a new weapon system that they failed to use. And he sees this as a likelihood, or at least a possibility, in nuclear weaponry. Rickover was very outspoken, and he likes to be provocative in his statements. And I think Rickover also made this prediction that we're ultimately going to use nuclear weapons in order to sober up maybe careless leaders who fool around with arms negotiation and don't really mean it. I think he's quite disturbed that we've not made any progress at all in recent years. There is a theory of negotiation or the resolution of disputes that is pursued avidly by people at Harvard, University of Michigan, and now by us at Emory University. And do I have time to just give you a little bit about that?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, William Ury was on this program just a few weeks ago from the Harvard Negotiation Project.
Oh, good. We're going to have later on this year at Emory at our Carter Center something along this line. But in order for that to be good faith negotiations, you've got to have some requisites. One is you have to admit that your adversary has something in common with you, a general desire for a common goal. You have to admit that your adversary has a relatively sure chance of being in existence long enough to carry out an agreement. You have to admit that
there's a touch of Jimmy Carter in the night, so to speak.
Yes.
He still comes across, doesn't he, as a decent man.
Oh, there's no doubt of it. And former President Carter is surely the best former president we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a reasonably good president at that.
These days, most people don't evaluate him that way.
Well, that's right. And because he was not a great president and so forth. And he didn't have the kind of charm that Ronald Reagan did and so forth. But that speech we just heard, or the remarks we just heard, that put me in mind very much of, I had mentioned earlier, President Kennedy's commencement speech at American University in 1963, in which he too said, follow the same pursuit, that in dealing with the Soviet Union at some point, we're going to have to recognize, I don't know his exact words, but that, we have something in common. They need peace as we need peace, perhaps want peace as we want peace. I wish I could quote that speech in its entirety, but the theme that former President Carter just struck in your clip there, I think was very much like President Kennedy had struck 20 years earlier.
We will be shortly stopping for some commercials and then a quick news update, and then we return to conversation with Tom Wicker. We come in just a moment to the next president in line, namely Ronald Reagan. Of course, the defeat of Jimmy Carter was... how close a thing was it, that election, the Carter-Reagan? Finally, it was not close at all, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was thought to be a close election during the campaign.
Yeah.
But my recollection is it's something like 2 days before the actual election, the polls that President Carter was getting showed that he was going to lose.
Yeah.
And in the event, again, I'm speaking out of memory here, but not only did he lose fairly substantially, not a landslide, but fairly substantially, but the Democrats lost the Senate as well.
Yeah.
It was, in 1980, it was a substantial Republican victory.
Of course, a central aspect of all of that was the way the Ayatollah voted. That is to say, the prisoners in the American embassy were still not released, and there may indeed have been a deal, we don't know. It is suggested by some there was a deal between the Reagan people and the Ayatollah and his minions in Tehran to release them after the election, but not to release them until the election occurred, thus further dishonoring Carter.
Well, that's one of those mysteries that I think is probably, until some demon historian in future discovers documents, I think it's going to go unanswered. I never really believed, but that doesn't mean it's true, because I didn't have as skeptical a mind as a good journalist should have, but I never really believed that the Reagan administration or its forebears, the people who were going to be the Reagan administration, somehow had in fact literally made a deal with Iran that they would not release those prisoners until after the election. I never really believed that, but on the other hand, I'm not going to say that it's not true. There's enough indications that maybe it was true that I don't want to be dogmatic about it.
Well, the announcement that the prisoners were released and were on a plane heading for...
It came on inauguration day.
Came on inauguration day.
Yes, exactly. Indeed. So, I mean, there, as I say, I don't want to be dogmatic about it one way or another. I just state for what it may be worth, and history may prove me to be a sucker. I never believed that, and I don't believe it to this day. But that doesn't mean it's not true.
Well, you're a gentleman, and you're suggesting that that Reagan was a gentleman, maybe even the Ayatollah was a gentleman.
Well, I never knew the Ayatollah. but I'm not suggesting that so much as I just think anybody certainly including Ronald Reagan, anybody who's going to be president of the United States is not, or likely to be, he's not going to go and make a deal with a foreign country to keep American citizens in prison as a means of getting oneself elected. I don't believe it.
Well, I'd like to think that you are right, and that is the case. We are late for some commercials once again. No surprise. We'll take care of those, a quick update on the news, and then directly back to Tom Wicker. And we return to Tom Wicker, and we are approaching the president in line who is the subject of his new book, which is titled, quite directly, George Herbert Walker Bush. It's the latest in that wonderful series of Viking biographies. James Atlas, the original editor of this whole series, has been on this program, as have a number of the authors who've done prior volumes in this series.
Oh, yes. It's been quite a distinguished series. I feel quite honored to have been added to it. I hope I held up my end out all right.
Oh, you have indeed. And we'll come shortly to what you've got in this. It's a brief biography, but it is jam-packed with not only with historical material, but also with very deft analysis, I would say. But first, his predecessor, or rather the man who chose him to be vice president, Ronald Reagan.
Yes, indeed. It's impossible to conceive of George H.W. Bush, that is, the first President Bush, as having become president had he not been chosen to run with Reagan. And indeed, George H.W. Bush got elected to the House of Representatives from a district in Houston in 1966 and was reelected in 68 without opposition and never won another election until being on the Reagan ticket and then getting elected president himself in 1988. So he didn't have a tremendous amount of election experience. Of course, Dwight Eisenhower had none.
Yeah.
Neither did Herbert Hoover.
Neither did Ulysses Grant.
I believe that's correct, yes, but I'm thinking about only here in our time.
It's a long and eventful presidency, the presidency of Ronald Reagan. What overview do you take of it?
Well, I take a much more favorable view of Reagan today than I did when he was running. I must say that I shared what was a rather conventional opinion in 1980 this guy is just an actor. He thought that trees caused pollution and all that. And I thought he was, some Democrat at the time called him a dunce, you know. And I now think all these years later that that was not so at all. I blame myself for misconception. And I want to insist here, however, that I did not particularly think at the time that Reagan was a great president, and I don't in retrospect. But I do think that I now think that Reagan was the strongest political leader we've had in this country since Franklin Roosevelt. I think he knew how to appeal to the country. He had the same thing Roosevelt had, a sort of a sixth sense of how the country would react to things.
And he had a clear program in mind.
He had a clear program, certain very simple principles that he followed. And I give Reagan great credit for one thing in particular, that he came into office believing, and the record is pretty clear on this, he came into office believing that a nuclear war could be won. And when he left office, he said a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And if we have a president who will learn that much in 8 years, why, I'm for him. I don't care whether I was opposed to him at the time or not.
And we come then to his vice president who succeeds him, runs for a term as president and gets it, elected in 1988, running against the governor of
Massachusetts. Michael Dukakis. And again, I say you can't conceive, and particularly if you go back and study that campaign as I have, you can't conceive of George Bush being elected president had he not been vice president under the popular Reagan. And indeed, he presented himself as the heir to Ronald Reagan in 1988, and he was nothing of the kind.
The economics was no longer voodoo economics.
That's right. He pursued it himself, or at least he certainly acquiesced in it as vice president. But the great conservative base of the Republican Party never really accepted George Bush. And I don't think he would have been elected necessarily in 1988. Perhaps that gives too much credit to Dukakis, who ran a very bad campaign. But just as a general matter, Bush did not have in 1988 the great devotion of the Republican Party that Reagan had had. And I think there's some question about his electability had he not made that promise at the New Orleans convention that there'll be no new taxes. Read my lips.
Read my
no
lips.
New taxes.
Exactly, yeah.
And then one of the reasons, and I think one of the strong reasons, that he lost to Bill Clinton 4 years later was because he broke that promise. He broke that promise less than 2 years after he'd made it. I think the current president has learned that lesson very well.
But you do, in this book, represent him, or at least those who advised him and ran his campaign, as going all stops out in their assault against Michael Dukakis.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Lee Atwater was his campaign manager. Roger Ailes was his television manager. And I don't know whether the two of them or not, but certainly Atwater, they conducted a what they call a focus group not long after, during the campaign, before Bush was actually running against Dukakis. And they found out weaknesses that Dukakis had that they could exploit, like the famous Willie Horton ad. You know, Dukakis, as governor of Massachusetts, had allowed prison inmates to have weekend leaves, which in general was not a practice only practiced in Massachusetts. It had been done elsewhere, usually with success. But in that case, Willie Horton became a murderer while on leave, and the Bush campaign used that ad very effectively.
And you feel there was also a racial angle in the whole thing?
Well, because Willie Horton is a black man, and the TV ads focused that way. And as early or as late as 1988, if you want to put it either way, there was a great deal of racial feeling in this country. You'll remember that Dukakis won the Democratic primaries, and there was a great controversy as to whether or not he would take Jesse Jackson as vice president, because Jackson had been the second most successful candidate in the primaries. And Dukakis did not do that. He chose Lloyd Benson, and a lot of people thought that there was a racial content to that, that Dukakis did not feel that a black on his ticket was politically advantageous. And in all honesty, in 1988, he probably was right. I'm not saying that he was right not to take Jackson, but he probably was right about the views of the country about race.
The single thing for which his presidency will be most easily remembered...
You mean George H.W. Bush.
George H.W.
Winner, yes.
Bush would have been the first Persian Gulf War, wouldn't you say?
Well, I suppose there are many things. The first Bush administration was very eventful. That's when the Berlin Wall fell.
To be sure.
Soviet Union collapsed. Eastern Europe became non-communist and so forth. We had the war in Panama, the savings and loan crisis. There were a lot of things happened during the Bush administration. But it's true that the first Gulf War and the victory there probably was the single most memorable thing in that administration.
Here's a moment of George H.W., telling the country that the troops are launched, the war has begun.
Now, the 28 countries with forces in the Gulf area have exhausted all reasonable efforts to reach a peaceful resolution, have no choice but to drive Saddam from Kuwait by force. We will not fail. As I report to you, air attacks are underway against military targets in Iraq. We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential. We will also destroy his chemical weapons facilities. Much of Saddam's artillery and tanks will be destroyed. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal.
It's interesting to hear that as we reflect on the Iraq war we are presently engaged in.
Yes, indeed. And the Gulf War, you will recall, ended with the first President Bush and Colin Powell, who was his Army Chief of Staff,
mm-hmm.
and Richard Cheney, who was the Secretary of Defense. They made the decision to leave Saddam Hussein in power for many good reasons. In fact, I thought it was a correct decision.
But
that was not least the reason why 10 years later, we get another war against Iraq.
Though they were expecting that Hussein would probably be toppled by revolting Shiites and or Kurds.
Internally, they thought that might happen. And also, there were a lot of geopolitical reasons there. many Arab countries had supported the war against Iraq, in that, but they would not necessarily have supported, in fact, they would have opposed the overthrowing of the Saddam Hussein government. The Saudis did not want a Shiite breakaway nation on their border. The Turks didn't want a breakaway Kurd nation on their border. There were a lot of reasons that I thought that the first President Bush was correct in not pursuing the war to the toppling of Saddam Hussein. Now, in retrospect, all these years later, perhaps that was not the right decision, but at the time it seemed to me to be the correct decision.
You know, I have a memory, literally standing outside this building one afternoon when a great victory parade was coming down Michigan Avenue, marching north on Michigan Avenue. It was only a month or two after the conclusion of that action in the Persian Gulf.
Oh, it was very popular, very popular.
And at that point, the polls had him up to some 90% of approval for his presidential performance.
That's correct.
So that everyone said, this, of course, gives him a second term. There's no question.
That's right. And he thought that. And a lot of the Democrats who might otherwise have been in the race that year, Albert Gore, for example, did not run because they thought, well, Bush is unbeatable.
I mean,
there may have been many reasons, but that was one reason.
Leaving room for a rather obscure Southern governor.
That's right. Rather obscure Southern governor who had a lot of problems of his own, Bill Clinton, who had sex problems and who had, it's popular to say he was a draft dodger, but I think it's more correct to say he had avoided service during the war in Vietnam, which indeed the current vice president did. And so Clinton had a lot of problems, but Bush had even more because he had thought that that Gulf War victory assured his reelection. It didn't. It was 2 years later. It had faded. We had a recession in the country, a very severe recession that Bush apparently had paid very little attention to. He had not particularly prepared a campaign before the year 1992, which was a little late to start even for reelection. And above all, he wasn't running against a weak candidate like Dukakis. He was running against what everyone thinks of Clinton as president. Clinton was probably one of the really good political candidates in recent history.
We'll come back to Bill Clinton in a moment. I've got some commercials coming yet once again. That is inevitable. But before we leave George H.W. Bush, the subject of this fine new, rather brief biography that Tom Wicker has written, it's part of the Viking series of brief biographies. Before we leave him, you do stress that he had something which you find in abundance in his record, namely a kind of affability and geniality and sort of personal decency in his human relations that you don't really find that much in other presidents.
No, that's true. One doesn't think of presidents as being sort of pleasant fellows, you know, with rare exceptions. And I think, for example, I say without prejudice, I think if it were that you would much prefer to have dinner with the first President Bush than the second President Bush. people wouldn't feel that way, but I would. He was a very pleasant gentleman in that sense. He sent lots of thank you notes, kept the addresses. It's said that by the time he left the White House, he sent 30,000 Christmas cards every year. Whether that's true, I don't know, but
His wife was on this program once,
yes.
And since she appeared, I've been getting a Christmas card from them regularly.
Yes, I'm sure. That's the sort of thing he would do. Yeah. He even, the policemen who would ride motorcycles in front of his motorcades, he'd send notes to them afterwards. So, you know, he was an affable sort of fellow, but that didn't seem to make much difference when he ran against Dukakis, because he savaged Dukakis, and that was one of the most... it was one of the bitterest presidential campaigns in my experience, at least before this one. This one may be pretty bad, too.
Whatever happened to Michael Dukakis? I know he went and started doing some university teaching,
yeah.
But I haven't kept up with him.
Well, he's dropped out of politics pretty much.
Yeah.
I think he does still do some teaching. In 1993, I spent a little time at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and I ran into Michael Dukakis there. It was kind of a ghostly experience, I must say, but I'm with you. I think he's just dropped out of sight pretty much since then.
We drop off the air for 3 or 4 minutes, and then we will return, though it is time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines right now. The number is, of course, 591-7200. 591-7200. If you're listening to us on the internet and want to reach us via email from some great distance, you can do that as well. The email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. We return directly after this. And we return to Tom Wicker. Our listeners have come to our aid, Tom, as they so often do, regarding the question of Michael Dukakis. Where is he? What's he up to? And a listener informs us that he's working for Amtrak. And our producer, Maggie Burnt, has just checked it out. She's Googled it, as they say. And the last we can find, that she can find, is that in January of 2002, Michael Dukakis was the acting chairman of Amtrak.
Well, I hope that that doesn't mean he was the chief executive officer.
Sounds like, well, chairman of the board, I would guess. I don't know.
Well, I think that's probably better.
Amtrak's had a lot of trouble since even 2002, hasn't it? True enough. We will be going
well,
to...
Well, I wouldn't want to leave it at that. Dukakis was a nice fellow, and he won the primaries very handily in 88. Yeah. I just think he ran a kind of a bad campaign, and it's not a happy one to think back about.
I quite liked him when he came on the program
as
part of the campaign, and he seemed rather hard pressed by then. That this was towards the end of the campaign, and
well, I'm sure he was.
I think they had much to worry about.
He did. Yeah. He did indeed.
Well, what about the man who beat him?
The man who beat Dukakis?
Yeah.
Well, my view of George H.W. Bush was always colored by that campaign because I thought it really, I've said Dukakis ran a bad campaign, but I thought Bush ran, I thought a reprehensible campaign.
We've touched upon that. But do you think he had any residual guilt or concern about that? Did he feel that he had somehow lowered himself?
I don't think so. He certainly never showed any signs of it. I wouldn't want to pretend, however. I'm not that close a personal friend of George Bush. Maybe he did.
Didn't he, or the people who were managing his campaign, run a less Machiavellian operation when he ran against Clinton?
Well, yes, but it was by that time Lee Atwater was dead, and Ailes was out of the mix, and they didn't have in Clinton quite as open a target as in many ways they had in Dukakis. Now that may seem strange when you think of all the weaknesses Clinton had, but in fact, Clinton was a much more aggressive candidate, and it was much more difficult to take advantage of his weaknesses than it had been of Dukakis.
I remember a moment in one of those debates, one of the Clinton-Bush debates.
It was probably the one from Richmond. That was very impressive.
Apart from various other things that went wrong for Bush that time, was it in that debate that he looks at his wristwatch?
Yes, he did.
Which conveyed just everything wrong, I felt.
Yes, and his staff later told the press, well, he was just looking at his watch because he thought Clinton was taking up too much time.
Sure.
But the impression, whether that's true or not, the impression viewers got was that he's tired of the whole business. He just wants to get out of it. And that was not the least of Bush's problems in 1992. Earlier, before it became clear that he was going to lose, the general population didn't think that he cared very much, particularly about the recession and about jobs. Yes. He vetoed a bill to extend unemployment insurance payments, for example.
We have to get to the phones fairly soon, so there isn't really time to do a full evaluation of the presidency of Bill Clinton. All the same, viewing those 8 years overall, what's your judgment?
My judgment is that Bill Clinton, being the impressive political figure that he was and being the impressive intellect that he was, that given even the good things that he did, and they were considerable, that it's too bad that those 8 years should have been much greater years. He should have been a much greater president than he was.
What prevented him from becoming so? The Lewinsky scandal, after all, doesn't come until late in his second term.
Yes, but then the Republicans took over Congress. Mm-hmm. There were many things, and I'm perhaps being unfair. I think in many ways that Clinton achieved a great deal. But I just think that from what I know of him, he was an impressive man who should have had a more impressive 8 years in office. For example, the pardons that he issued at the end,
those disgraceful,
I thought, were almost
pardons.
Scandalous.
Yes, they were, actually.
And he should have been above that.
Why did he do that?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there is the terrible Lewinsky business. There are those who were great loyalists for Clinton who say it was nothing. So it was a little bit of fooling around and hanky-panky sex, but that's no reason to impeach a president. Forgetting
well, I think
always,
that's true. It was no reason to impeach him.
But that
and indeed, they didn't.
That wasn't the nature of the impeachment
charge. They
couldn't
convict him. It wasn't the nature
of the impeachment charge.
Well, I mean, I think that... he was impeached for what? Lying to the public or something of the sort.
Lying to before a grand jury.
Yeah, but underneath it all, that's like saying the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was.
Yeah.
It may have been about other things technically, but it was about slavery. And the impeachment trial was about Monica Lewinsky. There's no question of that. I myself thought that was not sufficient cause to impeach a president, and indeed they didn't convict him for it. I don't hold this view of holding a president or a governor, as the case might be, to a standard that none of the rest of us meet. I don't hold with that, but people do, and Clinton didn't meet those standards.
We come at last to the son of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, I think the first thing to say about him, and I've always felt this, that his legitimacy is in question. I mean, he is not only a minority candidate, we've had lots of minority candidates in our history,
yeah,
or at least several. But I think the way that the Supreme Court finally certified him as president was beneath the Supreme Court.
It was a presidency injured from the beginning.
Yes, I think it was. And I think also for a number of years, it seemed at least, I think it's probably not so in retrospect, but it seemed that he was a kind of a figurehead president, that he was being manipulated from behind. And I think that, we know now, I think we know now, I certainly believe that we were manipulated into this war in Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction there. There was no connection to Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein, bad a fellow as he was, did not really pose a threat to us. So, and I think that in the long run, that's a far more serious offense than the Monica Lewinsky matter.
I've gone on record.
But he won't be impeached for that.
No, he won't be. And I should make clear to you, as a matter of simple honesty, that I've gone on record on this program more than once saying that basically I think it was the proper thing to do. And even though they haven't found weapons of mass destruction, I don't mean to argue this with you, and I wouldn't want to impose that on you.
Right.
But I just want to note that I take a different view of that. But certainly we are very aware. One has to be very aware that the country is profoundly divided, and as we are shaping up for the for next November, I don't know. My impression is that we've never had so much bitterness in a coming presidential race. Do you agree?
Well, that may well be so. I think in 1968 it would have been, had Lyndon Johnson continued in the race.
Yeah.
That would have been a very bitter campaign,
yeah,
because the war in Vietnam divided people at least to the extent, or pretty nearly to the extent.
But he did not continue in that.
But he didn't run, and therefore, it was very hard to be bitter at Hubert Humphrey, whatever else you might have felt about him. And so that campaign did not really shape up as this one may has come. I think there's a great deal of bitterness in this country against George Bush, and I'm speaking now from the perspective of people that I know who really feel strongly against George Bush. But I would say at the same time, I do not feel that there's a equally powerful feeling in behalf of John Kerry. And whether just a desire to get A out is enough to put in B, I'm not sure.
You've probably seen some of those stories, based on rumor, or based on inside dopester kind of privileged information, that there may be something underway to persuade Kerry to pull back and to do a kind of to grab the convention and to get the nomination for, of all people, Mrs. Clinton.
You mean that Mrs. Clinton would be nominated next August?
Yeah.
In this month? Well, there again, I'm probably gullible, but I really don't believe that. In the first
place, I don't believe it's possible.
First place, I don't think John Kerry would be a party to that. Not that he's all that honorable. I don't know about that, but I mean, I don't believe he'd give up his own ambitions to that extent.
I don't either.
I think that Mrs. Clinton, who in many ways is very likely to be the Democratic presidential nominee in 2008.
Assuming Kerry loses this one.
Assuming Kerry loses, or even if he doesn't, because he might be so unpopular that there would be an internal revolt against him. But I think she would jeopardize all that if she leaped in there now. And furthermore, I'll say that while I think it's possible that Kerry might win, I'm talking about next November.
Sure.
I do not think Hillary Clinton could win next November. I think there's still a great deal of residual not bitterness so much personally against her, but what one might term male chauvinist piggery in the country. I don't think the country is ready yet to elect a woman as president. I am ready to do it. I'm sorry about that. And I would indeed, I think it's high time we did that, us men having fouled up pretty badly, it seems to me, over the years. But I don't think Mrs. Clinton could win this year.
I'm sure.
08.
I'm not quite sure it won't happen, but I've read a number of stories suggesting that there are those who are working for something like that to occur at the coming Democratic Convention.
People love to sniff out a conspiracy even when there isn't one there.
Sure. We're going to pause. Quick round of commercials, then at last onto the phones. 591-7200, the number. Some lines are now available. Some people got tired of waiting, so if you move quickly, you may well get through. 591-7200. And we return to Tom Wicker, whose newest work is the biography of George Herbert Walker Bush, simply titled George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the Penguin Lives series, eminently readable. 591-7200 is the number, and here is the first caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. When Bush ran against Dukakis and the Lily Horton issue first popped up, I remember reading several Boston columnists who made a significant point, which is that when the parents of person that Willie Horton killed came to protest to Massachusetts, or I believe he's governor of Massachusetts. It's been
yes.
a while.
Yep.
When they came, they wanted to meet with Dukakis, and he refused, saying something like, "Why are these outsiders coming in here to protest this, and why should I meet with them?" And especially given that that's basically the same reception Northerners got in the South during the civil rights movement, and would have gotten Bush votes from, basically the black community in the South and black community all around. But that was never focused on, and just the fact that they had this furlough program was focused on. And it wasn't just not focused on by Bush, but it was also not focused on by Republican columnists, the media in general, etc. And I'm just wondering why that's the case, because it seemed like a very legitimate issue.
You mean that a legitimate issue that Dukakis refused to see these people?
Refused to see these people. They was reported to say, forgive me, it's been a while.
Well, it's all right. We heard what
you said.
It
certainly has. Yeah. I don't remember that episode myself.
I don't either,
to be perfectly frank. But I think if it was documented that these people, with that good reason, as parents, tried to see Dukakis and he would not see them, I think that reinforces what I said earlier on this program, that he was a very bad candidate. He certainly should have done it.
We go directly to another call. 591-7200 is the number. You are on the air. Good evening.
I'm honored. You have a journalistic giant at your microphone tonight. I'd like to ask you about reforming the presidential election process. But before I do, Milton, before you let your guest go tonight, would you ask him for a minute about the state of the New York Times today, and secondly, his opinion about Chronology after his role at Attica? But my question is...
Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Let's ask him those things right now. You'll get your other question in a moment.
Thank you.
Well, about the New York Times, I've been retired from the Times since 1991, and the end of 1991. So the sad events of last summer the plagiarism, the Jason Blair episode, I really know nothing about it, except that, of course, I was very saddened by it, and also Howell Raines, the editor who had to resign, was a good friend of mine. And so I was saddened that that happened to him. But I certainly don't in any way defend any of that. I do say that I think it's silly to say that, therefore, because that happened, one can never trust the Times again. I think that's going much too far.
I would have asked you differently. Is it as good a paper of record as it was?
Well, it hasn't been a paper of record for many years, because that assumes that, you know, everything gets in and all the documents. And so with the Times, it is not a paper of record. It is about as near to it as you get on the coast. You may feel that here in Chicago, the Tribune is a paper of record. But I don't think there is such a thing in the United States as a newspaper of record.
So it's not all the news that fits the print?
No, indeed not. That's a slogan, and it may have been many, many years ago. It may have been nearer true than it is today, but I don't think it ever really was true.
You were asking as well.
Do I go to my question or about Attica first?
Yes, sir. You know, your phone connection isn't really very good. So.
Okay, how's this? Better?
Not particularly, but let's go. The question about Attica comes up because of that major book you did about the Attica Revolt.
Yes, and I did do a book on it, and I've kept up with that issue. If I understood the question that came in with what do I feel about penology now?
Yeah, has there been any desirable change in the way in which we imprison
people? I don't think so. We've got a lot more prisons today than we had then. I don't know of that there having been any substantial prison reform anywhere. I don't think prisons, I thought prisons were pretty bad at the time of the Attica episode, and I think they're still pretty bad. I think the most impressive thing that's happened since then in the world of law and penology is, I think there is now, beginning right here in Illinois, a substantial movement against the death penalty, and I'm deeply in favor of that.
The caller, and we've had to click out on him because of that bad phone connection, probably a cell phone, but he was also asking about reform of our election system. Do you have any reforms you would want to recommend?
Well, the reform of the election system is one thing. If you're referring to reform of the voting system, well, of course, like everyone who watched the disaster in Florida,
no more hanging chads.
No more hangings yet. Now, exactly what is the best and most secure method of voting, I do not know. But it would seem to me that a proper follow-up to the Florida matter would have been for Congress to appropriate a lot of money and to appoint something like the current commission that's looking into the 9/11 to look into our voting and determine what is the best method and to provide the money for the states to go to that method. So that's voting reform. Now, election reform is another matter entirely. A lot of people favor a national primary, for example. I don't, because I think the system of state-by-state primaries makes more sense and gives us more judgment. I do think that the idea that somehow we've always got to have Iowa and New Hampshire first, two small states in either party, I think that makes no sense. I think I personally would favor something like regional primaries, say divide the country, I'm thinking out loud here, divide the country into six regions of about equal population and have six different primaries along that line. I would like, if I could, and I don't know exactly how to do it, but I would like to preserve the finality of the conventions. Instead of having the primaries settle the matter once and for all, everybody says now, of course, John Kerry is the nominee for the Democratic Party. Well, they're not even going to have the convention until, I believe, it's July or August. I don't see any reason why, at this moment, someone could not say, well, I want to be the Democratic nominee. I didn't run in the primaries, but I'm going to go to that convention with a lot of support. And someone coming in late like that, I think that might be very beneficial, at least the possibility of someone coming in that way. I don't think it's good for the Democratic Party, or it would be in the case of the Republican Party, to have a nominee settled upon in February, basically by Iowa and New Hampshire. I don't think that's good for the party or the country.
Another kind of reform or a change, it's been advocated by some people for many, many years, and it becomes all the more relevant considering the way in which the popular vote fell out this time, is to abolish the Electoral College.
Yes, I favored that. I have. I wrote several columns over the years. I favor direct popular election. And, of course, the objection to that on many part on many people's part is that then the big populous states would be dominant in that, and that states where there is, say, a large black population would get shortchanged because they wouldn't have the voice that they do. The large black population of the state of New York has a good voice in where New York's electoral votes go. If you had direct popular election, that voice might be diluted. I've never believed that. I have thought that direct popular election was the fairest and best method of choosing a president, and what happened in Florida makes me think so even more.
No. A last round of commercials, and then we'll be right back to the phones. 591-7200, some space is available on the board right now. If you've been trying to reach us, try again. Also, of course, the email is available, extension720@tribune.com. And directly back to Tom Wicker, and directly back to your calls to him. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, two questions, please, for Mr. Wicker. I thought that Eugene McCarthy was very sincere when he came out against the war. He wasn't elected president. Do you think he would have made a good president?
No, I don't think so. I knew Gene McCarthy very well, and I think you're right. I think he was absolutely sincere in his opposition to the war, but I don't think he was serious in, at least not at first, in wanting to be president.
Okay, and the second question?
Well, that second question is not going to come through, I fear. Cell phones, I think, are the great burden of modern talk shows.
And beepers.
Well, maybe, I don't know what that
is. I hate both.
591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, Milt. Fine,
yes, sir.
Show, as always. I would like to ask your guest the following two questions. How has your accuracy been at estimating who would be elected president in the past, and who do you think will win the election this year?
Well, my accuracy in the past, I'd have to run over it in my mind pretty clearly, but I haven't been clairvoyant by any means. I've, as they say, won some and lost some. But this year, I find it very hard to predict. It's always very hard to predict. I think if the election were going to be held tomorrow, that Bush would be reelected. But it's not going to be held tomorrow. It's going to be held next November. And what might happen between now and November, one just cannot know. Will there be another 9/11, just for one example? Who knows what might happen between now and next November? So,
if there were another 9/11, how would that affect the election?
Well, I think in many ways it would depend on the reaction. I would think just in general, another 9/11 would favor Bush because he is now president and he's got the power to do something in return. Whether he or not he would do it is another question. But that's an example of what I mean. And there are many things that can happen between now and November.
So some of it hangs also, doesn't it, on what happens in Iraq from here on?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I think it's not exactly in response to our questioner, but I think John Kerry should be focusing every day and every hour of every day on the war and the fact that, or this apparent fact, that we don't know how to get out of it and we didn't properly plan for the end of it, whether or not it was a proper war to begin with. I think that that's what he should be focusing on, but who knows? That's probably why I'm not the Democratic nominee.
Well, if he just focuses on critical commentary on the war, we shouldn't be in it. He still can't really advocate withdrawal, as Howard Dean was sort of advocating and might have if he had become
candidate. Oh, I don't think Howard ever nominated withdrawal. I mean, ever advocated withrawal. Maybe
he came rather close to it.
What he meant, Dennis Kucinich, I think,
more
the one
more
who
directly
really, advocated that. And Kerry, after all, voted for the war. So it's very difficult to him now, particularly since they're charging him with flip-flopping on all sorts of matters. A charge which I think is too nearly true I dislike that fact. But still, I think the war is so unpopular, and the fact that it's so clear that we did not have proper planning for the aftermath of the war, or how to get out of it, or what ultimately it has to do with the war on terrorism or the Middle East or anything of that kind, I think it's a great vulnerability for President Bush, and I think his challenger ought to focus on it.
I don't know how unpopular the war is. It's very unpopular with those who do not like it. If you look at the actual public...
Well, there are a lot of those.
There are a lot of those, but if you look at the actual public opinion polls, you still get a bare majority favoring our commitment in the war.
Well, I think public opinion...
And polls... a higher degree of approval of Bush's conduct of the presidency.
Well, that's slipping, though. And most poll takers will tell you that the actual figures in a poll don't matter as much as the trends.
To be sure.
And the trend for Bush has been downward.
Yeah. We go back to the phones, 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, there's so many interesting subjects, but I'll ask my initial question, which was some columnists were writing that there's no essential difference between Kerry and Bush with respect to Iraq, but of course Bush himself is a huge, isn't he the huge problem in getting other nations to be involved? Kerry could say, look at what that fool did here, and then Kerry has no axis of evil list to make war. Iraq was only number one. And then, of course, there's all Bush's baggage. We all know what's in that with his father, what his father did and his father's cronies in the past. So I think that there is a great difference between them, that Bush himself is the problem in a solution in Iraq. And
well,
Kerry had better start talking about it.
I certainly agree with you that there's a difference between Kerry and Bush. But I think that Kerry, as the Democratic nominee I think he's kind of dissipating the advantage that he should have from that difference. And I have said before to friends, and I'll say again, I don't mind saying on this program, I think if Kerry, having become the Democratic nominee, now decides to be simply a centrist candidate who does what the so-called leaders of the Democratic Party suggest to him, then I don't think there is going to be much difference. I think a Democratic nominee at this point, to quote Franklin Roosevelt, should be a little left of center. Not a lot left of center, but a little left of center.
I see.
There's a famous anecdote about that. Somebody asks his press secretary, how does the president part his hair? And the answer is, a little to the left of center.
is that where the phrase came from? I don't know.
I don't know, but
your memory is better than mine.
There's an anecdote in there somehow in the whole presidential
plan. Well, I think it would be fair to say, would it not, that Ronald Reagan was a little right of center, whether or not, I don't think, as was popularly believed, I don't think he was far right of center, but he was a little right of center. And I think progressive presidents who really make big strides into the future are either a little left or a little right of center. For my preference, I'd rather have them a little left. But I think centrist presidents, for example, I wrote a book about Dwight Eisenhower, and he was a centrist if there was one. And I don't think you can look back on the 50s and Eisenhower's two terms and say these were years of great advancement for the American people. The best thing you can say about it, and indeed it's a great thing, is that he kept the peace. We didn't have a war.
I think in your new book, your biography of George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush, you essentially classify him also as a centrist president, don't you?
Very nearly as a do-nothing president.
The place to do nothing is at the center.
Well, I suppose that's right. I suppose that's right. And maybe that's what I'm saying in the whole. But I think Bush is a man who, as I have said on this program already, he was a very amiable fella. He was able in all the variety of appointive jobs that he held. But I think he had no reason to be president except that he wanted to be president. There was nothing that he wanted to do. He didn't come into office saying, I'm going to provide health care for the American people, or I'm going to do arms control or anything of the sort. He just wanted to be president, and it was happenstance. He didn't do anything to cause it, really. It was happenstance that the Soviet Union and the Berlin Wall collapsed on his watch. That was coming on for a long time.
Interesting. We began our examination of recent American presidents with Eisenhower, but the man immediately before Eisenhower also seemed not to really have any strong intention to become president, namely Harry Truman.
No, he didn't, and could not never have dreamed that he would be president until Roosevelt chose him for vice president. But once in office, then Harry Truman became a president with very strong views about what to do. And
very assertive.
And I think, you know, Dean Acheson's book entitled President the Creation, I think the modern world in many ways was created in the Truman administration, for better and for worse.
Was it for worse or was it for
better? Well, in some ways it was, because Truman was a Cold Warrior. There was not very much anyone could have been except a Cold Warrior in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want to say that everything that Harry Truman did was just great, but I think on the whole he was a very creative and progressive president.
Is McCulloch's biography a bit of a hagiography?
McCulloch's book, McCulloch?
Yeah. His book on Truman.
I wouldn't say it's a hagiography, no, and David is a splendid writer and researcher, but I don't think the Truman book is as good as the John Adams book, and I don't think he does either. Mm-hmm. But it's, no, it's certainly not hagiography.
It's been, nor is the new biography of George Herbert Walker Bush by Tom Wicker.
Certainly hope not.
But it is an excellent work, utterly readable, and very good political history. And with that, we come to the end of the available time. Tom, it's been a delight to see you once again.
Thank you very much, and it's really been a pleasure for me to be back on your wonderful program.
As the governor of North Carolina said to the governor of South Carolina, a long time between drinks, right?
That's true, if that's what he said.
That's what they say he said. with that, we wind down for the evening. We'll be here with tapes after the ball games, both Tuesday and Wednesday, then full two-hour programs on Thursday and Friday. On Thursday, a basic program on child development with one of the major psychologists, expert in developmental psychology, Paul Bloom of the department where I spent my youth, namely the psychology department at Yale University. Until tomorrow after the ball game, thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.